KPBS On Demand is supported by Marichal Design and Remodeling, helping homeowners with their home remodeling needs. From ADUs to kitchen remodels, room additions, and custom homes, Marichal Design and Remodeling can help homeowners design and build their dream homes. More at trustyourhometous.com.
It's time for KPBS Midday Edition. On today's show, a local author takes us back to 1960s San Diego in a heartfelt story about family, faith, and war. I'm Andrew Bowen with conversations that keep you informed, inspired, and make you think. A new documentary takes viewers on a cross-country tour of the nation's grammar questions and explores language as a force of unity. Then, in our weekend arts preview, a concert celebrates the legacy of San Diego-based dancer and choreographer Gene Isaacs. That's ahead on Midday Edition. A new middle grade book takes us to the San Diego neighborhood of Palm City, where a young girl is growing up against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. The book Yoli's Favorite Things follows 12-year-old Yolanda as she makes a pact to keep her brother, Chewy, from getting drafted. Author Patricia Santana grew up in Palm City in the South Bay. Her other books include Motorcycle Ride on the Sea of Tranquility and Ghosts of El Grullo, both of which have received various awards. And Patricia joins me now. Welcome to Midday Edition.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a bit more about Yoli, the protagonist in this book. How would you describe her character and the journey that she goes on throughout the book?
Well, she's a very dramática little girl of 12 years old, and she is one of nine siblings. And she likes to think of her family as very similar to the family of the Von Trapps of her favorite movie, The Sound of Music. We won't mention the fact that she doesn't live in a mansion like the Von Trapps did. She lives in a little house with three bedrooms, one for the five sisters and then one for the four brothers and the parents. But that's okay. She still feels that there are many wonderful things that are similar to the Von Trapps. And so she lives in a kind of a reality, but also a fantasy that helps her cope with her everyday life.
Let's talk more about The Sound of Music and the role that that film plays in this novel. The title, of course, Yoli's Favorite Things, is a riff on that song from The Sound of Music. And so talk about the significance of this film in Yoli's life and the role that it plays in the story.
Well, it plays a very big role in that, just like the Von Trapps were dealing with the war, they were dealing with World War II, so Yoli and her family are dealing with the Vietnam War that has come and knocked at their door.
Hmm. And what can you tell us about the family dynamic that we explore in this novel? It's a large family, also mm-hmm. similar to the Von Trapps. What are some of the relationship dynamics at play here?
Well, the father is quite the patriarch. He's a very strict Mexican immigrant father, and he is very protective of his daughters, more so of his daughters than his sons. They can do whatever they want, but not his daughters. And so there's the sense of, especially with the older daughters, having to break the ice for the younger ones. Yoli and her sisters are saying, we don't live in medieval times, so please give us some more freedom. And that is one of the concerns of the novel, is trying to be American, but also being respectful of the Mexican traditions.
How did you draw from your own personal upbringing in San Diego, and how did that inspire Yoli's imagination or life in the book?
Very much so. I'm afraid, for better or for worse, right? I have been keeping a diary since I was 11 years old. And people often ask me how much of this is like your own life. And I would say, maybe 86.5% if it is. And I did draw lots from my family. and the experiences we had. I also felt it was important to highlight this Mexican-American family during the Vietnam era and the civil rights movement, because it doesn't seem like there's been much written about it. And I wanted to talk about one family's experience, both. So even though it is fiction, it is based, as my daughter says, it's autobiographical fiction, Mom. Mm.
So you started keeping a diary at 11 years old. That's pretty young. And do you go back and read them, or what strikes you about your own writing at that time?
Well, I started writing, yes, when I was 11 years old, and I started with a tiny diary, the ones that come with a lock, and then there's a small page for each day. But I realized that that was not enough space to write about my whole day. And I also read The Diary of Anne Frank for the first time after, you know, and then I've read it many times since. And that novel, or that book, actually, it's not a novel, but Diary of Anne Frank inspired me to make my own diaries out of remnants of my mother's sewing projects. And so now my diaries were big, you know, 8x11, and I could write to my heart's delight as many pages as I wanted for one day. And that's what I did. And when you're a teenager, that's so important, to have some sort of an outlet. And being in this big family where there isn't a lot of privacy, the diary and my writing allowed me that. It allowed me a certain kind of therapy to deal with everyday issues in my life in junior high and also in the family.
You've prepared a short excerpt to read for us from Yoli's Favorite Things. Would you read that for us today?
Oh, I'd be happy to. In this excerpt, Big Brother Chewy, who is about to be deployed to Vietnam, has just taken Yoli on a bicycle ride down Suicide Hill, where they tumble and get scraped up. In this scene, he's cleaning her wounds. He doused the cotton balls with alcohol. It's going to sting a bit, he warned, as he patted the wet cotton on the wounds, wiping off the gravel and dirt, the blood. And I started to cry, first just a little bit, and then I couldn't catch my breath. I was sobbing in gulps. Sorry, he said, quickly blowing on the cuts. I know it hurts, Yoli. It'll stop in a couple of seconds. You're pretty banged up. That's not why I'm crying, Chewy, I said. You know that's not why I'm crying. He dabbed the mercurio on the cuts and then unwrapped the band-aids, applying one to each gash, gently, carefully, as if he were performing delicate surgery. He avoided my eyes. Promise me that you'll come back, Chewy, I said. Promise me that. You know I can't promise you that, Yoli, he said. He crumpled the band-aid wrappers and dropped them in the brown paper bag, along with the bloodied cotton balls. He closed the cap on the alcohol bottle. All the way back, he didn't say a word. I sat on the bike as he walked beside it, both of us holding on to the handlebars as he steered us home.
I'm struck by Chewy's honesty to Yoli. You know, he says, you know I can't promise that I'll come back. Talk to me more about this relationship dynamic between Yoli and her brother Chewy. It's, in a way, really a driving force in the novel, isn't it?
It is. Chewy is I would say Chewy is one of her favorite brothers in a group of favorite brothers. And they have had a very special relationship. He's always been very protective of her, and she's always loved the way he jokes and acts goofy. So, yes, they have a very special relationship. And so she's very worried that he's going to be drafted. And, of course, now in this scene, it's happening. He's about to be deployed, and she's just terrified, which is why she makes the pact with God. But even then, she knows, and probably the reader realizes it pretty soon, that it's inevitable that he's going to be drafted.
There's so much detail about the neighborhood of Palm City, where I believe you grew up. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
During this time in the 1960s, what are some of the unique details about this neighborhood that you wanted to fold into the story?
Well, I think I wanted to, one thing I wanted to certainly do is talk about community, the way they all come together. You have Don Epifranio, one of the oldest members of the neighborhood, and Doña Socorrito, who is kind of the gossip of, and she has an opinion on everything. But the sense of community and in Palm City that I have in the novel, but also in my real life, there was a wonderful solidarity of coming together during difficult times, like with the Vietnam War and Chuy being drafted.
I've also noticed there's several references to the Interstate 5 freeway, which so many of us drive on every day. It's something of an imposing presence in Yoli's life. There's a spot where she sits on the edge of a canyon and she can look and hear and see the 5 in the distance. There's one passage where you write, car sounds on the freeway competed with the cooing of mourning doves nesting nearby. What was your relationship like to the freeway back then, which at that time was pretty new, and what's Yoli's relationship with it like?
Both relationships are very similar, both Yoli's and mine. To me, because the canyon overlooked the freeway and you could hear the whoosh, whoosh, I like to think that it was waves, the waves of the ocean, which was about 5 miles away. It was very comforting. The other thing, the freeway brought the community together because whenever we'd hear a crash and we'd all run, no matter what time of day or night it was, the whole neighborhood would run to the end of the street that overlooked the freeway down the embankment. And it was a time for us to chat and gossip. And somebody would always call, you know, the ambulance and say, okay, there's a crash on Freeway 5 by Palm Avenue and Main Street. And then we'd just hang out there and have a kind of impromptu neighborhood chat.
Hmm. So you mentioned there's a pact that Yoli makes with God. It's part of your exploration of Yoli's relationship to her own faith. Can you talk to me more about that? How did you want to approach that and depicting the complexities of faith?
Mm. Lydia is Yoli's best friend. And so they made a pact when they were 8 years old to become nuns when they grow up. But now that she's 12 years old, Yoli has a crush on the altar boy, and she's not sure she wants to be a nun. And so one of her preoccupations is how to tell this to Lydia. But when she's thinking, no, I don't want to be a nun. How can I be a nun if I have a crush on Benjamin Sandoval? But then she makes a pact with God and decides, all right, if you keep Chuy from the war, I will become a nun and I will go to Vietnam and be a missionary nun and help repair the country.
And is becoming a nun something that you ever considered in your life?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Another parallel to Sound of Music there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this book is also a prequel. Can you tell us about the other stories that you've told in this universe?
Right. It's a prequel to Motorcycle Ride on the Sea of Tranquility. And in Motorcycle, Chuy returns. The very first chapter, he returns from Vietnam. And when he returns, he's not the same brother before having gone to Vietnam. And in that novel, it's about trying to heal, help Chuy heal through the PTSD that he has.
These are really heavy themes, mental health, war. How do you approach writing these themes specifically for a younger audience? This is meant for children 9 to 12, I believe, right?
Correct. Partly, I look to my diaries. And partly, I think I have the heart of a 14-year-old, especially when I'm writing. I do get into character. But with this particular novel, I did go to my diaries. And because I wanted some dates to be very accurate in terms of when, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke his speech and then his interview with Merv Griffin and things like that. So I did look to my diary because my diary had these moments I didn't even have to Google it so much. I had it in my diary. So I think reading my diaries when I'm 12 and 13 years old helped put me into that voice.
You spoke earlier about the power of writing, especially in turbulent times, which I think we're experiencing right now. How do you think about that today, and how do you find healing through this process of writing?
Oy, well, you know, we are going through some difficult times, and writing about the 1967 helps me realize that we do have, we've had this before. We've had other difficult times. And I think it helps me stay positive and hopeful that we will get through this. And that's what my writing does always, is it, I always end with a hopeful note. I have to.
And Yoli's coming of age in this, you know, really seminal moment in American history. There's a lot of societal upheaval and change. How do you think Yoli's experiences reflect the experiences of young people today?
Oh, I think there's lots of challenges for young people, and in some ways more than when I was growing up. But I think reading about other people, other young people having these challenges, I hope it brings them some sort of healing and some sort of acceptance, and to go forward and to be active as best they can.
So given that this book is in large part based on your own life, your own family, I have to ask, has your family gotten a chance to read it yet?
Yes, yes.
And what did they think?
Well, I'm always afraid, you know, you know, how they're going to react, if they're going to say, well, it didn't quite happen that way, or, oh, which sister am I supposed to be? And so I don't answer those questions, but they have been very, very pleased. And as a few of them said, oh, it took me back to that time. And one of my sisters drove around Palm City just to relive those memories.
You said, I think it was your daughter who told you this is something like a fictional autobiography. Why did you choose to make it a work of fiction and not a memoir?
Well, interestingly, I was going to make this book a memoir, and I wrote about 50 pages, and then I came to the Von Trapps. I said, oh, well, you know, the Santanas are a lot like the Von Trapps. And then I paused. I said, I think I'm going to make this fiction because it allows me more freedom and the chance to be more creative. And then this way, with a memoir, I always feel like perhaps I'm going to step on people's toes and did I get the dates right, et cetera. So I thought, nope, let's just make it where I'm a little freer about telling the story.
You said you like to end your novels on a happy note or a hopeful note. What do you hope readers take away from Yoli's Favorite Things?
Oh, I hope that they will be hopeful as well, and that even when things are dark, find the light. Find the light, even if that means fantasizing that you are the Von Trapps escaping over the Alps.
Well, I've been speaking with Patricia Santana. She's the author of the new book, Yoli's Favorite Things. Patricia will be doing a reading and signing at the Book Catapult in South Park tonight. That's Thursday at 7 p.m. She'll also be doing an event at the new Barnes & Noble in La Jolla Village Square on November 1st at 4 p.m. And you can find all of those details at kpbs.org/midday. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, hear how one filmmaker traveled across the United States to talk to people about grammar.
I probably deal more with the common themes. You know, like people want to know how to use apostrophes in South Dakota, they want to know how to use them in Florida, they want to know how to use them in Oregon.
How language can unite us when Midday Edition returns.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back to Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman. A new documentary opens up next week at Digital Gym Cinema. It's called Rebel Without a Clause. The film follows Ellen Jovin as she takes her pop-up grammar table on a road trip across 50 states, navigating dangling participles and split infinitives along the way. KPBS arts reporter Beth Accomando spoke with Jovin and her husband and filmmaker, Brant Johnson, who are now on the road touring with the film.
Ellen, you have an obsession with grammar. Where did this all start?
I think in my early childhood and possibly earlier in my genetics. I think it's a combination of nature and nurture. But I've always just loved language. My earliest childhood memories are mostly of language incidents.
How did this passion for grammar turn into a documentary?
Well, I've always lived a very grammar-filled life my whole life. I've been a writer. I've taught. I've studied a lot of languages. So I always had a ton of grammar things going on in my life. And one of the main differences between, say, 9 years ago and 8 years ago is this $40 folding table I bought, which just allowed me to move it to the street. So all my activities, basically, whatever I was doing online or in my brain. So I set up this table outside our building, and then Brant began loitering.
Yeah, I would sit at a park bench nearby and just take in what was happening at the grammar table. And Ellen plopped it down for the first time in September of 2018. And after a few weeks, I was convinced I really needed to start filming. So I started shooting in December of 2018.
I just realized my math was off.
Yes, it wasn't 8 years.
The difference between
6.5 years ago.
I don't know. Time is so exciting to have a grammar table that the time issue just gets confusing.
It's okay. You're a grammarian and not a mathematician.
Well, actually, I was captain in my high school math team, so I don't want my former math teacher to hear this.
And Brant, when you decided to make this into a film, I mean, documentaries are hard to, you can't script them in advance, really. But what did you kind of have in mind in terms of what you were hoping to maybe capture and put into a documentary?
Well, what I was hoping to capture was the spontaneity and genuine joy, fun, humor, connection that was happening at the table. And I really wanted to do that justice. And if I could sort of get out of the way and have people be able to experience what the handful of people were experiencing when they arrive at the table, that I could bring that to a broader audience, that would be fantastic. So I didn't have beyond that a structure or a very specific idea. I wanted to have this movie be about this. I let it emerge. I shot 400 hours of footage in our travels, and it was 6 years of editing that to have emerge what emerged.
All right, I think this is a good moment to listen to a little bit of the trailer and hear some of the energy from the people you were speaking with at that table.
Can you start a sentence with and or but?
I do it all the time.
Boom!
I'm a huge Oxford comma person.
Yes!
And it drives me crazy
when
at
you
work
see when they don't
like,
put the comma before the final item.
I had to teach my ex-husband the difference between well and good.
Mm-hmm.
And I should have known that very minute that it would be X someday.
Okay, here we go.
I'm ready.
So explain what the film is about in the sense you guys decided to travel around the country with your grammar table. So what kind of prompted that and how was that experience?
Once it became clear, as soon as Ellen plopped down the table, that it was a hit. People came up to the table immediately, had questions, wanted to vent, wanted to talk. And so that prompted someone, and people started asking Ellen, well, you should write a book about this. And Ellen thought, that's a good idea. And I was going to be shooting the film and thought, well, let's have the travels and the shooting and the road trip be part of the, Ellen made that part of her proposal for the
part of my book proposal. That's true. I initially did this just for grammar hedonism. It really just, I don't know, it changed so quickly. And I love seeing places that I haven't seen before. So we've been tourists all over the country already. Having a grammar advice stand and setting it up on the streets of a random place is I think it has to be one of the most efficient ways to learn about the community that you've just entered into, because people share, language is intimate. And so they share stories from their childhood. You meet their relatives, their children. It's just really, it's very moving.
And did you notice anything geographically in terms of what kind of things people were interested in, or particular kinds of language issues that came up in different areas? I mean, I'm just curious if there was any sort of difference or pattern in terms of your travels.
There are regional differences in English, but I would say more often, there's a lot of people move around the United States a lot. And we were often in major urban areas, although not always. So I probably deal more with the common themes. You know, like people want to know how to use apostrophes in South Dakota. They want to know how to use them in Florida. They want to know how to use them in Oregon. So that's similar. We did have some y'all, more y'all discussion in the South.
The proper way to use y'all.
Y'all.
Tell me, does the apostrophe go before or after the A?
It don't go at all. What are you talking about?
Before.
Oof.
With thank after- you. I agree with that. Wait. I hate because they use it after the A. I can't stand it.
All y'all and all y'all. And then hardly anyone ever asks me about the word ain't, but for some reason, just statistically, probably just chance, two people asked about that in Ohio and nowhere else.
So, Brant, with 400 hours of footage, how did you tackle that? And did you kind of think in your head about a format or a structure so that you could pare that down more quickly than to just, you know, that's a mountain of film.
Yes, indeed. Well, the first step was just to understand what I had and just to catalog it. It was a giant mountain of data. And tagging, cataloging, recognizing themes, and just having it really a giant database in the program I was working in to edit it, to be able to cross-reference and think, oh, here's a theme. Where did I see that? And be able to just search for it. So that took months and months just to know what I had. I heard a great quote. It is, if you don't know where something is, you don't have it. I like that. So I have this thing. Where is it? I don't know. Well, you don't have it.
That's good.
I know.
It really helped me organizing things.
Yeah. So I thought, first off, I need to know where stuff is. Otherwise, it's just lost in a mountain of, and I might as well not have it.
And I'm actually speaking with you while you are in the car that you've toured the United States with, and you're now touring the film?
We are. We are going all over the country to screenings of the film, doing Q&A sessions afterwards. Ellen is setting up her grammar table at these screenings, many of them. And it's fascinating that after the experience of the grammar table itself, and that was, you know, all over the country and interacting with communities and building little communities at the table, that these years later, now that the film is done, it's sort of picking up where we left off, or rebooting the travels of the grammar table in a different way, but still a sort of community building, exploring the country way again. We just counted up. We're at the 30 something states with screenings of the film, and it looks like we're going to close in on 50 before too long.
And what you do at the grammar table is very personal, because you're actually interacting with people every time they come up to your table. With the film, you're kind of sending it off into the world, and, you know, people can watch it on their own. So what do you hope people are kind of taking away from that film if you're not there at the grammar table to add an extra element to it?
There are a huge number of grammar nerds in the world. You know, people, even people who say they hate grammar, we'll stop at the table and ask a question about something. I think people get this idea that it's an icky thing that they didn't enjoy in school, but they still, we all negotiate language in our daily lives. So I hope they enjoy the language part of it. But I also think in our lives, we need to have time for the things we have in common and that give us peace and pleasure, so that we don't there's a lot of negativity around. We do actually still I'll punctuate mostly, and and deploy language. So I want them to feel that thing, that sense of community, whether they're at the table or not. And I think the way Brandt filmed this has made that really possible for them.
And this film, for sure, it's a grammar road trip docu-comedy, rollicking, fun film, but at its heart, it really is about human connection.
Absolutely.
And you are actually coming to San Diego to our Digital Gym Cinema. You've already sold out your screening with Martha Barnett. Talk about coming to San Diego.
Well, I'm very excited about it because I grew up in Southern California, Los Angeles specifically, and I believe my first encounter with San Diego was the zoo on a field trip in school. We've been there since, but it's going to be really wonderful to be in the area where I actually, in the general area where I learned a lot of the grammar that I use in my life. That's going to be a lot of fun. And to see some of the grammar nerds we've accumulated through our travels already. We've met, made lots of grammar friends. Some of them are in San Diego. Some of them have read the book. And it's just, I actually kind of start crying sometimes. I try to not be too obvious about it, but it's so moving to me to see people again that we met through this thing that has been so special. So I'm looking forward to it. And I love Martha.
So do you have any particular fond memories of shooting and anything like that stood out for you that maybe surprised you?
So many fond memories of shooting. The whole experience was really miraculous, and the interactions of every imaginable person, kind of person coming up to the table.
But you have a favorite.
I have a couple of favorites. One visit for me that was, it was January 13th of 2020. It was our last stop before COVID hit. We didn't know at the time, of course, but two young men strolled up to the table, and I was just getting set up with the gear and everything. And
in
Decatur, Alabama, as soon as they started talking, I thought, oh my God, this is just too good to be true. And I was just scrambling to get the gear set up and press record. That single take went more than an hour before I paused the camera because the hits just kept coming. Those young men were just fantastic.
They were at work, supposedly, but they stayed and talked to us instead. And they were a little profane, very irreverent. They're the opposite of what the stereotype of a grammar nerd is. So that's always interesting. You think you know who's going to have the grammar questions, but no, it's the chain smoking guys wearing a leather jacket. And they just, I can't repeat some of it on the air.
And that surprise was such a central feature to the whole experience of just the confirmation that you just don't know when you look at someone, you don't know whether they're going to love grammar or not, or love something else or not. And that sort of surprise is just a wonderful part of the whole experience.
I think that's also just why the surprise of the people who come up to the table, but also the surprise of the table itself. I think life is more fun when you have surprises, and, just it's little, but if you suddenly come across a grammar advice stand on your way to work, where you can ask a question about a comma that's been bugging you. I like that in my own life in other ways. Not, I don't like surprise parties, but a surprise pop-up grammar advice stand is different.
That was KPBS's Beth Accomando speaking with Ellen Jovin and Brant Johnson. Their film, Rebel Without a Clause, opens at Digital Gym Cinema next Thursday with a sold-out screening featuring Away With Words' Martha Barnett. But fear not, there will be additional screenings through October 30th. Still ahead, the founder of San Diego Trolley Dances showcases her life's work. Stay tuned. Thank you.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back to KPBS Midday Edition. I'm Andrew Bowen, filling in for Jade Hindman. For our weekend arts preview, we take a look at a San Diego dance legend's 60-year career, a zine fest, the popular streaming convention TwitchCon, and more. And joining me with all the details is KPBS arts reporter Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, welcome.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
So first up, you talked to Jean Isaacs this week. She's the longtime artistic director of San Diego Dance Theater, and she's probably best known for starting the popular Trolley Dances series, right?
Right. And she retired in 2021. She was artistic director of San Diego Dance Theater for 24 years, and that's when she started and developed Trolley Dances. But she had like this entire career of choreography before and during that. She says that she has 150 dances that she has choreographed. It's pretty impressive. So this concert is a chance to celebrate that legacy. There'll be a bunch of dancers, including longtime collaborators like the also legendary Monica Bill Barnes, who worked with Isaacs when Barnes was based here, Blythe Barton, Ivan Flores, Cecily Holcomb, and more, including Jean Isaacs' own daughter and two of her young grandchildren.
Aww.
And even Jean herself will be on stage. She's now 81. And she said that she does tend to get dizzy and mostly just dances in her chair with her grandkids. But she has been practicing and will be on stage for this concert. She said that she'll depend on Monica Bill Barnes to support her, literally, if she loses her footing. And depending on others is kind of an extension from her career. She's always worked with other choreographers. She told me that this is the first time in her career that a show is just her choreography.
In all those years, in all those 150 dances, none of them were just Jean Isaacs. But it's something about the human condition and what does it mean to be together with other humans, and when you're not together, which often happens as you get older.
And, you know, I remember talking to Isaacs almost 4 years ago when she was about to retire, and she was feeling so disheartened about the work of running a dance company, the work of creating art in a society. And this was early 2021, not traditionally an easy time for performing arts, the industry. So I asked her this week if she's feeling any differently after some distance and some rest. And she for sure is feeling more at peace. And a big part of that is her family.
I feel very lucky that I've been given this thing that not only me, but my children and my children's children also see the beauty of live concert dance. They love it.
So it's going to be extra meaningful that two of her grandkids will perform her choreography this weekend. There's two concerts on Saturday, 2:30 p.m., and then an evening show at 7:30. This is at Liberty Station's Lightbox Theater, which is a really nice and intimate place to see a performance.
So it's also the Zine Fest this weekend. I have to say, every time you bring us with something that was already on my radar, I feel extra cool.
I feel cool now.
Yeah, great. So what can you tell us about the Zine Fest?
Yeah, so this is the 13th annual San Diego Zine Fest. And yeah, I'm super excited about this one too. Zines and DIY culture in general, they're just really thriving right now. DIY art, like zines, they're built upon this idea of accessibility, that anybody can make and produce something on whatever topic they want. And this started decades ago. All you needed was like a copier and a stapler. But the Zine Fest celebrates all of it. It's at Woo Studios in Barrio Logan this year. There'll be dozens of artists, small presses, and also other creatives sharing and selling their stuff. They'll have musical performances and DJs all day each day and some after-hours events from 6 to 8. And Zine Fest is always packed. It's just a really nice way to browse so much local talent. But also people come here, vendors come here from out of town. It's an attraction. And this is 12 to 8 Saturday and Sunday, and it's free.
And we love a free event.
Love a free one.
And there's a local gallery that is honoring the work of painter Wayne Thiebaud this week. What do you know about this?
Yeah, so late American artist Wayne Thiebaud, he's known for these almost like pop-like, whimsical paintings of everyday objects. And I mostly know him for like his desserts, so the pie slices, these ice cream cones, candies. But he also had these thoughtful, line-driven landscapes, cityscapes, and even some portraiture. And La Jolla's Tassendi Gallery, they're opening an exhibit tonight showcasing Thiebaud's work and also celebrating the release of a new book about him and his work. It's a collection of essays, and one of the contributors is local art historian and curator Derek Cartwright. And they'll be doing a book signing that's tonight at 5 o'clock in La Jolla.
So let's transition to literature. Tell us about the Indie Reading Series that's happening on Sunday.
Yeah, so this is a literary journal and reading series. It's called Peel Lit, and they're going to release their second issue and also a chapbook. And to launch these, they'll do a reading with a bunch of writers, including Lyra Montoya, Allison Evans, Becca Ray Rose, and more. It's 7 o'clock on Sunday at Burn All Books in Normal Heights. Really great space to hear a reading and also a chance to shop for a bunch of zines and small press books if you can't make the zine fair.
And we got to talk about TwitchCon. This is a very big event happening this weekend. It's the annual convention of the streaming platform Twitch, and it's celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. So what's on your arts and culture radar at TwitchCon?
So Twitch has so much culture, the convention or the platform. There's gaming, esports, cooking, drag performance, and believe it or not, Bob Ross.
Oh, we love Bob Ross.
We do. Bob Ross is huge on Twitch, and we all know that he's famous for like this genuine belief that anyone can paint and anyone can paint a beautiful picture. He's famous for this like wet on wet painting technique and also his catchphrases. Happy little accidents. And there's a channel on Twitch dedicated to his work. They do rewatch parties of old episodes of The Joy of Painting and also paint-alongs with what's called a certified Ross instructor. About 6 years ago, I went to TwitchCon and I participated in the official Bob Ross paint-along. It was magical and like really amazing to see people actually doing it. I decided to call up one of the instructors. These are women who became Bob Ross instructors decades ago. And I wanted to ask them why they do it, what's so great about Bob Ross and Twitch. This is Faye Dasher. She called me when she was traveling here for the convention.
I love how he will, you know, just talk about, you know, happy accidents. And he just is so real. And it feels to me like apart from the art instruction, but it's like a hug coming through. I feel like a lot of the young people and all of us actually could use that, a warm Bob hug.
And one of the things that I heard about Bob Ross is that he used to pretend that he was talking to one person when they were filming the show. And that connection got me thinking about why something like Bob Ross is so popular on streaming, like why it works. And it's like this early version of parasocial connection, like the kind of thing that we look for in our internet celebrities. So this is going to be Friday at TwitchCon. It's at 11:30. They're going to fill a room, hundreds of convention goers, and they'll do an actual paint-along, all materials provided. And TwitchCon passes, they're not cheap. It's $160 for the full day, $169, or $249 for all 3 days. But the variety of things you'll find, performances, panels, hands-on activities like this, it rivals Comic-Con, if you ask me.
Wow. How about folks who like live music? Mm-hmm. What are your recommendations there?
Okay, so there's a show Friday night at Petco Park's Gallagher Square. It's Indie Darlings, Rilo Kiley, and Waxahachie. Dream lineup, if you ask me. Waxahachie had an album come out last year. It's called Tiger's Blood. And that really solidified her as one of the greatest American songwriters working right now. This track is Much Ado About Nothing. And band, Rilo Kiley. They've been around since the late 90s. They got really big in the early 00s. This is the project of Jenny Lewis. I'm going to leave you with my favorite Rilo Kiley song, With Arms Outstretched, from their 2002 album, The Execution of All Things.
And if you want me, you better speak up.
And you can find all the details on these and more arts events on our website, kpbs.org. I've been speaking with KPBS arts reporter and host of the finest podcast, Julia Dixon Evans. Julia, thanks.
Thank you, Andrew. This is fun.
To the promise.
And that's our show for today. I'm your host, Andrew Bowen, in for Jade Hindman. Thanks for listening to Midday Edition. Have a great day.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers, offering a new 2025 lineup of vehicles at your local Toyota dealer, including a new Tacoma with turbocharged four-cylinder engines and a hybrid powertrain option. The San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.